Quite good, John said. Can Zack and Ginger have some? The two dogs were by his side, tongues hanging out, panting, both with eyes fixed on his empty bowl. Across the years, it had become an unconscious act. Leave a little extra on the plate, set it down. When Ginger joined the family, John would make sure two plates would go down at the same time, because no matter how much the dogs cared for each other, if there was only one plate, there'd be a lunge and a yelp, usually from Ginger losing out to Zack. But now, as Zack was starting to show his age, he was becoming the loser in those squabbles.
"We ran out of dog food yesterday," Michaela said quietly.
Damn, he had never even thought of that. Even the canned stuff? Michaela didn't say anything, and he realized with a shock that the reason she said nothing was because she or Jen had stashed the canned dog food for emergency use, if need be. He suddenly wondered if they made a canned dog food of hot dogs, but knew it was best not to ask.
"Come on, Dad, they're starving."
He looked down at his two buddies. His companions on many a late night of writing or research, they'd always be curled up in his office. Once it was time for sleep, Ginger would usually paddle off to Jennifer's room, Zack always to his. He looked at Jennifer, then back to the dogs. "Sure, come on, you two fools." He picked up his bowl and Michaela's, doled out one ladleful each of the soup and put the bowls down. The two lunged, devouring the meal within seconds. Jennifer smiled, watching them. Michaela said nothing. "I think I want to go into town to see what's going on, maybe over to the campus."
"Don't press your luck, John,"
Jen said, a bit breathless from hiking down from the field, coming up to his side and standing on tiptoes to kiss him.
"Damn, you really do stink," she said disapprovingly, stepping back.
"I'll drive,"
Michaela interjected.
"Besides, now that our patient is better, I think I should go back up to the nursing home and oversee the transfer up to the conference center."
Jen said nothing as Michaela went into the house. Elizabeth pecked him on the cheek and sat down to eat.
"She's a nice girl," Jen said.
"I think she's in love with you, Dad,"
Elizabeth announced, saying it as if just commenting on the weather or the time of day. Jennifer giggled at that. John looked over at Jen.
"She sat up with you 3 nights straight. You were in a bad way there, John."
Jen smiled, but he could see she was just about in tears. "What is it, Mom?"
"Oh, nothing."
And she turned away. And he knew she was thinking of Mary. The drive into town, things looked pretty much the same, except for the fact that several of the men he passed were toting shotguns or rifles. At the elementary school there was a huge stack of firewood, a number of kettles set over a fire boiling. "How are things in there?"
"John, people who just can't make it are dying off," Michaela sighed. "Hundreds dead. But things are under control for right now."
At the station he found out that Charlie was up in Swannanoa, Tom up at the barrier in the gap. He read the town notice board, printed with red marker on the whiteboards tacked to the side of town hall. Martial law still in effect. John noticed the eraser marks for everything else on the board except for those 5 words, "martial law still in effect." 1. It is estimated that 20 escapees from the interstate are still at large in the region. If they are cited, apprehend, detain, or if need be, use whatever force necessary, then report sighting to this office. 2. Ration cards will be issued starting today for everyone in the community. If you are a resident with a home and you apply for a ration card, you must submit to your property being searched for food. If food is found, it will be confiscated and then distributed to the community. Do not apply for rations unless you are in true need. Starting tomorrow, you will not be issued food at any public facility without presentation of the ration card, along with proper identification. John paused at that one and thought about it. He realized it was a good decision. No threat of taking food, only if you asked for food. It'd keep hoarders from trying to eat off the public wheel while continuing to sit on their own stockpiles. He continued to read. 3. The outbreak of salmonella at the Emergency Refugee Center has been brought under control. Our thanks to the volunteers from Montreat College and the staff led by Dr. Keller. We regret to report a total of 61 dead from the outbreak at the center. Community-wide, it is reported that 310 have died from salmonella, with over 3,000 cases reported. 4. The new emergency hospital at the Ingram's Shopping Plaza in Swannanoa is open. If you need transportation to that facility, a public vehicle will leave here at noon every day hereafter. 5. Principal Green, acting now as superintendent of schools for our community, has officially announced that all schools are now closed for the academic year. Classes will resume the day after Labor Day. Upon resumption of school, grades for the previous academic year will be posted. John found that to be curious, that they had finally gotten around to canceling school. He'd have to tell the girls. They'd be delighted. Also, it was a touch of optimism that some sort of continuity would continue come fall, and he was glad to read it. 6. Death notices. 81 deaths reported in the communities of Black Mountain and Swannanoa yesterday. Remember, all bodies are to be interred at the new community cemeteries, the golf course in Black Mountain, the upper grounds of the Swannanoa Christian Academy, above the floodplain for the Swannanoa River. Cause of death must be confirmed by the physician on duty in the respective town offices between the hours of 8 in the morning and 5 in the afternoon. The names were listed, and John scanned it. One he knew, a student of his, cute girl, a sophomore, a bit overweight, with a smile that could light up a room. He remembered she suffered from severe allergies to bee stings, a notice having been sent around to all her professors at the start of each semester, to be aware of that situation and immediately get her out of the room if a stinging insect flew in. He wondered if that had been the cause of death. 7. Take notice. If there is a death in your family and your family has accepted ration cards and that death is concealed, all ration cards for the immediate family will be permanently confiscated, except for those for children under the age of 11. But said children will then be moved to the refugee center. If you are not a permanent resident of the community, you and all immediate family will be expelled, except for children under the age of 11. That bothered him, the last sentence. It was still the defining of a different class within the community. Michaela was standing beside him reading the notice board, and he wondered how she felt about it. 8. News. It is reported by one of our residents who has reached us after walking from Greensboro that there is an operating shortwave radio in Morganton. The resident claims to have heard a broadcast from the BBC in London. The British government has declared solidarity with America and even now is mobilizing massive relief aid. Long live our allies of old and of today. John smiled at that. And if true, it could mean that perhaps, just perhaps, communications gear was on the way to help reestablish links. The downside, why only Great Britain? 9. War news. This same resident reports that the attack is now believed to have been 3 missiles, fired from a container ship in the Gulf of Mexico. Our forces overseas are engaged in heavy combat in Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Korea. There is progress on all fronts. Responsibility for the attack rests upon an alliance of forces in the Middle East and North Korea. Reports now confirm that a weapon similar to the ones that struck the United States has also been detonated over the Western Pacific, creating the same widespread outages in Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. A similar missile is also reported to have been detonated over Eastern Europe. It is reported as well that the federal government, even now, is organizing the distribution of radios, which shall originate out of a stockpile kept in a secret reserve. Communications are soon to be reestablished with central authorities. 10. All announcements placed upon this board are official and in force from the time of placement. Claiming of ignorance of said laws shall not be accepted as an excuse for noncompliance. Signed, Charles Fuller, Director of Public Safety. We shall win through to ultimate victory. God bless and preserve the United States of America.
John turned away from the board and looked at Michaela. What are you thinking? He asked.
Feel like I'm in a bad movie or novel, she sighed. Long live the king, or long live our glorious leader, or something like that should be on the board.
We are nowhere near that yet, John said coldly.
Might as well warn you now. I'm one of those old-style liberals who used to see conspiracies behind everything the right wing did.
He looked at her and saw a trace of a smile. I used to feel the same about the left, and now it was his turn to smile. Seems absurd now.
Still, to go from where we were 3 weeks ago to this, it's impossible to grasp.
They walked back to the Edsel. He noticed that the parking area around the police station had been cleared of all the newer and now useless cars. There was a row of half a dozen VW bugs, courtesy of Jim Bartlett, stenciled on the side of each with an old-fashioned peace sign added in. That must really rankle Tom, John thought. Two old Jeeps, one of them the antique World War II Jeep with a white star stenciled on the hood, an assortment of cars from the 50s and 60s, a few from the 70s, the years that Detroit really started to turn out junk, which didn't survive as well as the older ones. A number of older motorcycles and mopeds as well. To his surprise, a couple of horses were tethered there as well, and he stopped to look at them.
Stables at the kids' camps. Over 40 horses in the community, Michaela said. Most were appropriated by Charlie for patrolling the back roads.
She walked up and rubbed the horse's nose, and it nickered.
Used to love riding. And you?
Actually, yes. The freedom of it when you're out on open ground. But it's been a while.
Poor things.
Why?
Charlie said we can use them through the summer, but once we go through the cattle and pigs, they're next.
He nodded, saying nothing. They got into the Edsel, Michaela still driving, and headed up towards the college. As they approached the arched stone gate, a huge, hand-lettered sign greeted them. Halt! You must stop!
He rolled to a stop, and two of his students, both with shotguns, blocked his approach, weapons leveled. But upon their recognizing him, there were grins.
What the hell is this? John asked.
Sorry, Professor. Interior defense. Some of those runaways from the interstate are still out there. Also, we're starting to get people trying to sneak in off the old toll road behind us. Sergeant Parker has posted a 24-hour guard here.
John nodded, saying nothing as Michaela drove through the gatehouse and then into the campus. All was quiet here, and then he saw them, lined up on the grassy slope in front of Gaither Hall. He motioned for Michaela to pull over and stop. He sat in the car for a moment and watched. Damn, it was like boot camp. 50 kids, a platoon-size unit, standing at attention, inspection arms, and every kid was indeed armed. Some had shotguns, others hunting rifles, a few stood there with pistols. Every weapon imaginable, from a Chinese SKS to 22 semi-autos to a monstrous double-barreled 12-gauge shotgun, and he quickly recognized two boys carrying reproductions of Civil War 58 Springfield rifles. He got out of the car to watch. A few of them looked his way. One girl grinned and started to wave. Then, realizing what she was supposed to be doing, she came back to attention. And there was Washington Parker, walking down the line, grabbing a weapon from one student, levering the bolt action back, looking into the chamber, then slapping the weapon back into the student's hands.
Not clean enough. You want to live? You keep your weapon clean.
John slowly walked up, and the eye contact from students was a tip-off to Washington to turn. There was the flicker of a smile, and Washington came to attention and saluted.
Good day, Colonel, sir. Care to inspect the troops?
John found himself returning the salute.
Are we feeling better today, Colonel, sir?
Yes, Mr.—he fumbled for a second.
Yes, Sergeant Parker, I am. Thank you. Embarrassed, John turned to look at his students, kids of but 3 weeks back. He had spoken to them more than once about the privileges they had, that kids their age were defending them on distant fronts even as they sat half-dozing in class. Several graduates of the college had been in Iraq, another in Afghanistan, and whenever an email came in from overseas, John usually read it to these same students. And now they stood lined up with guns, in front of the main campus building that housed the admissions office, the registrar, the music department, and one of the two chapels on campus. He knew they were expecting him to now say something, but words failed him. He saw his two favorites, Jeremiah and Phil, to the right of the line, Sergeant Chevron stenciled on the dark blue college T-shirts all of them were wearing, like uniforms. Jeremiah and Phil made eye contact, and he nodded. He wondered if these kids knew what he had done in the park. Of course they did. The whole town knew. And as he gazed at them, he could see it in their eyes. They were looking at him differently. He had been the executioner. He was no longer the history professor who, though a former military man, was seen as having a soft heart. "They look good," was all he could say as he turned to face Washington, who saluted him. John returned the salute and headed into Gaither Hall. "Rather paramilitary, isn't it?" Michaela asked, returning to his side. John did not reply. He walked into the building and for a moment wasn't sure what to actually expect. Of course, the corridors were darkened, the air heavy and humid. Fortunately, the building was old, having been designed long before central AC, so at least there was some circulation. The door to the admissions office and registrar were closed, but he could hear a piano in the chapel. He motioned for Michaela to follow, and he opened the door. The chapel had been built in the 1930s. Just as the chestnut blight had ripped through the Carolina Mountains, so the trees had been harvested off and now were the beams, paneling, and ceiling, a beautiful, warm, dark, golden wood. Austere to a certain degree, for this was, after all, a Presbyterian school, but still a wonderful chapel in John's eyes. Up on the stage, several kids were standing around the piano, Jesse, one of the music majors, just fooling around a bit. A student whose name John did remember, Laura, said something. Jesse played a few chords, and she began to sing. Instantly, John felt his throat tighten. Laura had sung this song in the spring musical review, and though it was from a play that he thought was way too sentimental, The Fantastics, the song was haunting, and to him, such a metaphor for all that was happening. "Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow." He felt Michaela's hand slip into his, and they were silent. He could feel a shudder run through Michaela. She was crying. Laura's voice echoed, "Try to remember when life was so tender that no one wept except the willow." John could hear Parker shouting orders outside, the students now going through the manual of arms. It was almost too much for him to bear. It wasn't supposed to happen here. But it had happened here. Laura finished the second stanza and drifted into the third. "Deep in December, it's nice to remember, although you know the snow will follow." "I can't bear this," Michaela whispered. They slipped out of the chapel, Laura, the others, not even knowing he had been there. Michaela leaned against him for a moment, sobbing, and his arms were around her, and then she stepped back, breaking away from his embrace, looking up at him.
"Sorry."
"No, it was rather nice, actually," he said. The song finished in the chapel, and he started out of the building, then noticed that the door to President Hunt's office was ajar. He tapped on it and walked in. The administrative assistant, Kim McMurdy, was not behind her desk. That was a disappointment. She always reminded him a bit of the actress Nicole Kidman,
perhaps better looking, actually, and he had to admit he was smitten with Kim in a friendly sort of way. Friendly, of course, because her husband, the director of computer services, was a darn good friend. And besides, Mary was still a haunting presence. What had just happened with Michaela? He wasn't sure how to react to her now.
"President Hunt?" "In here."
John walked into the back office and was startled. Hunt seemed to have aged a dozen years in as many days, eyes sunken, hair disheveled. And then John wondered how he looked as well, still wobbly, unshaved, filthy, exhausted.
"John, you look like hell."
"Well, sir, if you don't mind me saying so, you look like hell, too."
Dan pointed to a chair, and John sat down. He had always liked this office. John looked back and saw Michaela out in Kim's office. Michaela nodded and left, motioning that she'd wait outside. The first time he had come to this office to be interviewed for the job that Bob Scales had engineered for him, what caught his eye was three paintings on the far wall. The first was what was to be expected of a president of a Christ-centered college, a nicely framed section from Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, the hand of God reaching out to touch Adam. The other two, though. The second was sort of a transition between religion and the military, a painting of Washington kneeling in the snow at Valley Forge praying. The third was Howard Pyle's The Nation Makers, a stunning portrait of a line of Revolutionary War infantry going into battle, men tattered but defiant, the American flag little more than a rag, but going forward relentlessly to what could only be ultimate victory. The paintings were still there, as always, but as John turned to look back out the window at the students drilling, Pyle's work took on new meaning. Dan was silent, and then, to John's surprise, reached into the bottom drawer of his desk and pulled out a bottle of scotch and a couple of coffee cups.
"If the Board of Trustees ever knew about this, they'd hang me," Dan said.
And John wondered if he was being serious or just joking. It was, after all, a dry campus. John took the offered cup and waited for Dan to pour an ounce. He held it up.
"For the Republic. May God preserve her," Dan said.
The two drained the cups down in a single gulp, Dan exhaling noisily as he put his down.
"What's up, John?" Dan asked.
"Well, sir, I guess you knew I was out of the loop for a week or so."
"You had us scared there, John.
At chapel, every day for the last week, Reverend Abel and the kids offered prayers for you."
"Well, it most certainly worked," John said, looking down at his hand.
"What about classes? Are they still meeting?"
Dan shook his head.
"Remember, most of our faculty live miles from here. No, classes are canceled."
"But you still hold daily chapel."
"Now more than ever," Dan said quietly.
That was reassuring, darn reassuring, a link to the past somehow. And yes, as well, in any time of crisis, churches would fill up again. The Sunday after 9/11, John remembered the small chapel he and Mary used to go to over in Swannanoa was packed to overflowing.
"I felt I should check in, see what was happening on campus. After all, this place is my job," he hesitated.
"No, actually my life, in so many ways. I was wondering if there was anything I should be doing here now."
"Appreciate that," Hunt replied softly. "But I think you have other responsibilities now."
John said nothing.
"I heard about your role on what people are now calling the Council. I think it's darn good you're part of that. They need someone like you. Focus your efforts on that. Don't worry about us."
"These are my kids too, Dan. I worry about them."
Outside came the echo of Washington's voice chewing someone out. He sounded like a Marine D.I. again, the right edge of sarcasm, but, in respect to the traditions of the campus, at least no overtly sexual, scatological, or downright obscene phrases thrown in.
"To survive, to keep these kids alive. We're selling our services, Dan said quietly. But there's a lot more behind this as well.
John stood up and walked to the window, empty cup in hand, and watched as Washington, finished with the inspection, now started to run the kids through some close-order drill.
"What is that out there?" John asked. "First platoon of Company A of the Black Mountain Militia," Dan said.
"What?"
"Just that. Charlie Fuller and I agreed on it a couple of days ago. 150 kids so far. The other two platoons are out on a conditioning run up to Greybeard and back. We'd have more, but that's all the weapons we could find so far. Company B will start forming up once we get more weapons."
"Isn't this a little overboard?" John asked.
"Hell, I know Washington's a good man, a great man, actually, but come on, Dan. What is he doing out there, getting turned on with old memories that it's Paris Island or Quezon again?"
"In truth, John, yes.
I guess you heard about the riot at the Gap."
"Yes."
It was then that Charlie realized something, and Washington had most likely put the bug in his ear already. "We need an army."
John sighed. 3 weeks ago, those kids were dozing in classes, trying to sneak up to Lookout Mountain with their boyfriend or girlfriend, or maybe, just maybe, studying for exams. Now we're making them into an army?
"I was younger than them when I lost this," Dan said, and he slapped his left leg, a hollow thump resounding.
"You were a lieutenant at 22 yourself."
"Yeah, but Dan, this is a college, a small Christian college up in the mountains of North Carolina. Somehow it just doesn't feel right to me.
Where else in this entire valley are there 400 young men and women in fairly good shape to start with, intelligence, pretty darn good, already imbued with a sense of identity for the school and those who lead it, like you, me, Washington?"
"I don't know," John sighed, watching as the column went to right flank march and two girls screwed up, Washington in their faces and reaming them out so that one was crying as she tried to march.
"We had 600 kids here on the day before things went down," Dan said, now at John's side and watching the kids drill.
"About 150 have left, trying to strike out for home. That was hard. You were not here for that meeting in the chapel. A lot of praying, soul-searching. I advised them to stay, told them that if anything their parents would want them to stay here until this crisis was over, knowing that they would be safe. Most who left are local, a day's walk away, but a couple of them are from Florida, said they felt they should try and get home."
John shook his head. The ones trying to get to Florida were most likely now facing hundreds of thousands heading the other way.
"The rest agreed to stay. Remember how, several years back, we had all those discussions and faculty meetings about orienting the college more to service? A couple of other colleges in the area, our rivals, were touting that all the time. So we put into the curriculum community service. That's what we're doing now.
Dan, there's a hell of a difference between kids working at a homeless shelter or community daycare center and drilling like an army."
"I don't think so, John. The times, as the old song went, are a-changin'."
The column of students turned and marched back across the green, weapons at the shoulder, and the sight of it sent a chill down his spine. He looked back at Pyle's painting, and then back to them.
"My God, no difference," John realized.
The tradition of close-order drill was a primal memory left over from the days when armies really did go into battle that way, shoulder to shoulder. Today, it was supposedly about discipline and spirit, and the fact that soldiers were at least expected to march. But no different. No different from what he used to talk about with such enthusiasm at the Civil War roundtable and see at reenactments. The difference was, though, this was for real. From close-order drill, Washington would take them to elementary tactics, fire and movement, holding a fixed position,
laying down fields of fire, assault of a fixed position, marksmanship, leadership in combat, emergency first aid, infiltration tactics, hand-to-hand combat, how to kill with a knife, how to kill with your bare hands. The sight of them drilling such struck home, as forcefully as what John had been forced to do in the park.
"Washington thinks the world of you," Dan said. "By the way, he told me what happened in the park. Said you handled yourself well."
"Handled myself well? I puked my guts out."
"No, not that. First time you shoot someone, if you got any heart in you, any touch of the divine spark, you should be horrified." He looked off.
"I lost my leg during Tet. The day before that, though, I was on point. Turned the corner of a trail, and there he was." He sighed, shaking his head.
"The Thomas Hardy poem. Remember it?"
John nodded. "I shot at him and he at me, and killed him in his place.
Well, I got him first. He was walking point for his unit, and we just ran into each other. Before I even quite realized it, I emptied my M16 into him. Hell of a firefight exploded, and I was on the ground, lying by his side, and I could hear him, gasping for air. Do you know what he said?"
John was silent, half suspecting.
"He was crying for his mother."
I understood enough of the language to know that.
His voice trailed off, and John could see tears in Dan's eyes.
"The kid I shot," John said, "certainly wasn't calling for his mother. He died filled with hate."
"Perhaps he sees things different now," Dan replied. "I know it's not orthodox with some, but I have a hard time not seeing God as forgiving, even after death."
John tried to smile. There were some on campus who were rather traditionally hard-line in their views of salvation. Dan had never voiced this view before, and it was a comfort, for the memory of that twisted kid's final seconds lingered like a recurring nightmare.
"Washington told me how you reacted, and the kids know that, too. Remember, this is a Christian school, and the reaction could have been bad if it seemed you were cold-blooded about it. So a lesson was taught there, John.
But it's what you said as well that resonated. Washington, and later Charlie Fuller, told me that at that moment we as a community were balanced on a razor. Charlie had made the right decision, but he did not know how to see it carried through correctly. You did. At that moment we could have sunk into a mob, or worse, a mob that would then follow a leader, even a leader of good heart like Charlie, but still follow him with bloodlust, and thus would start the slide. You're the historian. You know that of all the revolutions in history, only a handful have truly succeeded, have kept their soul, their original intent. Though it struck John as slightly melodramatic, Dan pointed to the portrait of Washington, kneeling in the snow.
"I don't think we are in a revolution," John said. "We're trying to survive until such time as some order is restored. Communications up, enough vehicles put back on the road to link us together again as a nation."
"But suppose that never happens," Dan said quietly.
"What?"
"Just that, John. Suppose it never happens. Suppose the old America, so wonderful, the country we so loved, suppose at 4:50 p.m. 18 days ago, it died. It died from complacency, from blindness, from not being willing to face the harsh realities of the world. Died from complacent self-centeredness. Suppose America died that day."
"For heaven's sake, Dan, don't talk like that," John sighed.
"Well, I think it did die, John. I think our enemies caught us with total surprise. We should have seen it.
I'm willing to bet there were 100 reports floating around Congress warning of this, experts who truly did know their stuff screaming that we were wide open. It happens to all nations, all empires in history. Hell, you're the historian, you know that. And at the moment it does happen, no one believes it actually is happening. They can't comprehend how their own greatness can be humbled by another whom they view as being so beneath them, so meaningless, so backwards, so as not to be a threat. You know that, John. 9/11, Pearl Harbor, were like flea bites in comparison to this. The Mongols hitting Eastern Europe in 1241, John said softly. The Teutonic Knights, when they first saw the Mongols at the Battle of Liegnitz, supposedly laughed hysterically at the sight of their opponents on horses so small they were the size of ponies, ponies that would be crushed under the first charge of lancers. They lowered their lances, charged, and at 150 yards, the Mongols decimated them with their compound bows, unheard of in Europe, each bolt hitting at 50 yards with the kinetic energy of a .38. 30,000 Mongols annihilated tens of thousands of Europe's finest that day. Dan nodded. The French knights at Crecy, mocking the English longbowmen, the British mocking us at Monmouth and Cowpens, the Germans disdainful of the Russians in 1941, John said. And us in Vietnam, Dan said quietly. Though that was not a war for our national survival, but it certainly was for them. I remember going over there, filled with a bunch of crap about how we were going to walk all over the gooks. Well, I've not walked right since. Nation-makers out there, John. Some of our profs might think I've sold this college to the community, but the hell with them. I know a college nearby, one that put out a lot of majors in peace studies, and if there was a protest anywhere against our military, they'd show. It was almost required. If an army recruiter ever showed up there, they'd get mobbed, all in the name of peace, of course. Can you imagine you or me ever getting a job there? Diversity worked for them only as long as you towed the line with their views. And now the whirlwind is upon us. He sniffed derisively. They'll never make it now. I bet on that campus today they're sitting around like the French nobles did at Versailles, even as the mob swarmed over the gates. I bet they're singing Give Peace a Chance, even as they starve to death. Well, that's not going to happen to my kids, Dan said coldly. And in our doing so, our community will survive as well. 150 for Company A, another 100 for Company B once we get the weapons in. You take a close look, and a couple of those kids are carrying reenactor Springfields from the Civil War, by the way. The others are doing community service work or working on other projects. Kids that helped stop the Salmonella outbreak, volunteering up at the isolation ward. Already have a crew of kids starting to cut firewood for the winter. Professor Daniels, with the Outdoor Ed Department, figures we can retrofit a couple of the old oil boilers to burn wood in this building and the library and have steam heat. We'll need over 300 cords of wood, though. Professor Lassiter is talking about rigging up a water turbine in the dam at Lake Susan. He thinks we could have it up and running by autumn and have electricity. John could not help but smile. Most of the towns in the area back 100 or more years ago first got their electricity that way. Entrepreneurs would come in, sell the community a generator, show them how to hook it up to a mill dam, string some wire, and the miracle, what was then the miracle, of electricity, arrived. Professor Sonnenberg tells me that in our school library are back issues of Scientific American all the way back to the 1850s. Also, Popular Mechanics. In those golden pages are plans from 80 years ago, 100 years ago, to build radios, telegraphs, steam engines, batteries, internal combustion engines, formulas for nearly every advance in chemistry. In our library we got darn near every issue of Mother Earth News and the Foxfire books.
Dan chuckled at that. Most of the other profs had viewed such publications with disdain, but on the faculty was a beloved old professor from before your time, now dead, who was definitely, as the kids said, a granola eater. That prof left us a gold mine. How to find food, how to preserve it, how to store it up. We got several groups out now, those books in hand, harvesting enough to keep us alive. Hard to believe, John, but rattlesnake shish kebab isn't all that bad. It's all at our fingertips, if only we look down at our fingertips to see it there. But the kids out there must keep this place secure, and if need be, buy time. Buy time for what? We have the passes secured. You know about the fight there, don't you? Dan asked. Yes? Well, that was a disorganized mob. Word is starting to filter in that groups are starting to come together. Most are just scared people banding together for survival and mutual protection. Exactly what we are doing here. But some, John, there's rumors about cults. A family that was allowed to pass through here yesterday, actually heading east, coming out of Tennessee, said that over by Knoxville, there's a guy claiming this is the start of a holy war. And let me guess, it's his vision of holiness you subscribe to or you die. Dan nodded his head. Says that Jesus appeared to him just before the power went off and gave him his mission, that he is the new John the Baptist, preparing the way for the final return. And good God, supposedly there are hundreds now following him and killing those who disagree. Several weeks, that's all it's taken, John sighed. Dan rested a hand on his shoulder. Just remember Ecclesiastes, John. A time for war, a time for peace. So now it's back to this. And back to kids drilling on the town green. I want to think that across America today there's a thousand such groups drilling in order to keep civilization intact, so that we don't become a mob where one eats only because he is stronger than others, or we kill each other in an insane frenzy of crazed beliefs. That's why those kids out there are drilling. And that's why I want you to be in command of them. Me? He asked, incredulous at the suggestion. Hell, you're the one with a vision. I'm a college president, Dan said with a smile. A one-legged college president. A wounded war veteran, John replied sharply. Yeah, a dumb 18-year-old kid from Moxville, North Carolina. So damn stupid I couldn't see I was in a minefield. But I got the GI Bill, disability checks, and since I could no longer run or play ball, a realization that I had to be something else. So here I now sit. John, while we work here, I want you to lead in the town. Charlie is a good man, a damn good man, but his focus, it's on the moment, on survival for the community, and God bless him for it. But we need something more. We need someone with vision who can see beyond, like the song said, to patriots' dreams. You have the respect of everyone in this town now. The kids, the community, the police, Charlie, everyone. Why? John said coldly. Because I fumbled the job of blowing some junkie's brains out? No. Because of what you said before you blew his brains out, as you now so crudely put it. Maybe that poor devil-consumed kid really did have a purpose in life after all. Maybe it was to give you that moment. For some, the fact that you did shoot him, well, for some that created fear and awe. But for the rest, they heard your words and will not forget them. John, that gives you a power. And you did hold the rank of colonel and were offered a star, which you turned down for Mary's sake. Mary's family is an old family here, and you tossing over being a general to bring her home was the talk of the town back then, and I think you saw on day one the respect everyone held for you. Frankly, he did not.
He was far too focused on Mary, and yes, somewhat bitter as well that the powers that be in the Pentagon had not found a way around his problem. But that was in the past, and for so many reasons, now especially, he thanked God he was here in this place. Dan, my entire combat experience was 100 hours in Desert Storm, nearly all of it locked up in a Command Bradley, one minor jolt when a shell landed 100 yards away, and that was it. Heck, give it to Washington. He's the D.I. He's the guy who was at Khe Sanh. He doesn't want it, and he fully agrees with what I'm saying here now. He explained it to me the other day when we began to plan this unit and the question came up of command. I left it open, at first thinking he'd take it, but he immediately said you should be the one. What did he say?
He laughed.
Said he knew he was the best D.I. in the United States Marine Corps, but it takes more than that to lead an army. He wants someone with an advanced education, someone who will remain cool under stress, someone who studied war and knows the history of it, and can thus apply it in a crisis. Of course, that means you, John. I think if it ever comes to a major fight, it should be Washington on the firing line. But he wants someone like you behind him. I still think he should lead. He's von Steuben out there, John, even though his name is Washington, and he knows that. It's your job. And Charlie agreed that if a crisis comes where a militia is needed, you lead it. Thanks, as if I wanted it. John, if you really did want it, I don't think your name would have been in the hat. We wanted someone who would see it as a service, and above all else, even while defending this community, would be thinking ahead to afterwards. John, we dream of America. We want America to come to us, but I think it never will. The America we knew died when those warheads burst. If so, then it is up to us to not wait, but instead to rebuild America as we want it to be. Chapter 8 Day 35 There was an air of celebration in the crowd that gathered about the town hall as John pulled into what was now his usual slot in front of the fire station. The fire trucks, which had been rolled out over a month ago to make room for the emergency supplies stockpiled inside, were still in place, still motionless, no longer sparkling, somewhat dusty. Horses were tethered to the bumper of one of them. The crowd stood around expectantly, and many, seeing him approach, stepped back slightly, nodding greetings respectfully. All were showing signs of the effects after 35 days. Faces were thinner, pinched on some. Clothing, in general, was dirty, sweat-stained, hair greasy, many of the men beginning to sport beards, and all of them stank. He wondered if this was indeed how people really smelled 100 years ago, the scent of a crowd of unwashed bodies. Or was it that 36 days ago people were used to sterility, terrified if their deodorant failed and they offended, nearly all taking a shower at least once a day, many twice a day in the summer? Was this now normal? Was this how Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln smelled, so normal that it just was no longer really noticed? Tom appeared at the door of the police wing of the building, grinning.
It works!
A ragged cheer went up from the crowd, which then gradually began to drift apart, though many pressed up to the doorway and windows to look into the conference room, as if what was inside was some sort of miracle. John edged his way through and into the building.
We'll start in a few minutes, but for right now let's enjoy this, Tom replied.
John stepped into the conference room and had to smile at the sight of the old crank phone attached to the wall.
Yes, yes, I hear you,
Charlie shouted, earphone in one hand, bending over slightly to shout into the speaker.
Yes, I understand. It works. Now keep setting up the wire. Yes, over and out here. Goodbye.
He hung up and turned to face the gathering. We got a phone system.
There was a round of applause picked up by those gathered outside. John looked at the contraption, salvaged from an antique store, as he suggested, a comparable phone now set up in the police station in Swannanoa. It had taken the work of a dozen linemen, older employees of the phone company, several of them refugees allowed in through the gap. Fiber optics, modern wiring systems, were out. They had to find old-fashioned copper wire, a hard task, but bits and pieces were salvaged from a variety of sources. A golden find, an old abandoned telephone or telegraph line of several miles along the railroad tracks. The wire had to be carefully spliced together, then strung on glass or ceramic insulators, most made out of soda bottles. It was the first line, the goal now to run it into Asheville. Remarkably, an old-style switchboard had been found in the basement of the granddaughter of a phone operator from the 20s. When the system had been junked back in the 50s, apparently the old lady had her board toted home as a keepsake. A couple of the elderly phone company workers were now trying to remember how to rig it up, an actual switchboard that could handle dozens of phones. There were other accomplishments. One of the junkyards in Swannanoa had successfully gotten a tractor-trailer diesel from the early 60s running. That had triggered intense debate as to who would get it, the fire department finally winning out, and on a flatbed were now attached hoses, ladders, and gear. They had even figured out how to use the engine as a power takeoff to run a water pump. Fire had become a frightful hazard. Those who still had food were cooking with wood, and home fires and brush fires were commonplace. The community still had water pressure for those places lower than 2,500-foot altitude, the height of the face of the reservoir dam, but above that it was hauling buckets, and the potential of house fires turning into out-of-control forest fires kept everyone worried. Between the two communities, there were now over 100 vehicles running, and more coming online every day. Several mechanics had learned to bypass and yank out the electronics, especially on cars that only had minimal dependence on them, slap on some old replacements, and get the engines to turn over again. A moped shop had become highly successful at getting their relatively simple machines running again, along with older motorcycles. There were so many vehicles running now that a salvage generator had been hooked up at Smiley's and the gas from Hamid's below-ground tanks was flowing again. Smiley's had become something of the old general store. There was precious little to sell, other than his legendary hoard of cigarettes, which were now doled out one at a time in exchange for a dead squirrel, old silver coins, or whatever might capture Hamid's fancy. John almost regretted his sense of fair play that first day. He should have purchased a dozen cartons. He was down to 5 packs, and rationing himself to no more than 5 cigarettes a day now.
"Okay, everybody. Time for the meeting, so let's clear the room," Charlie announced.
Those who had gathered to gaze at the phone reluctantly left the room. Charlie closed the windows and dropped the Venetian blinds. It was the usual group. Charlie, Tom, Kate, Doc Keller, and John. Carl and Mike from Swannanoa came down from their end if there was something directly related to them at the moment, but today were caught up with a forest fire up along Haw Creek that was threatening to turn into a real inferno. A ritual John had insisted on was now enacted, the group turning to face an American flag in the corner of the room and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And then Kate led them in a brief prayer, before Charlie announced the meeting was now in order.
"I hate to jump the gun on the agenda, but I've got something important," John said.
"What?"
"Outside news."
"Well, for God's sake, man, why didn't you say something when you came in?" Charlie asked.
"Everyone was excited about the phone, and, well, frankly, some of it isn't all that good."
"Go on, tell us," Kate said.
"There's a station on the radio now, Voice of America."
"Wow, when?" Kate cried.
"I was driving last night, fiddling with the dial in the car, and it came in clear as day."
"The radio?"
Charlie shouted. Tell us about it. My God, we got radio again.
The old radio in the Edsel. I don't know, I was just fooling with the dial, and suddenly it came in loud and clear, frequency at the old civil defense band. We sat there listening to it for a half hour or so, then atmospheric skip, and it faded.
We?
Kate asked. He didn't reply. Michaela had come down to join them for a meal and check on Jennifer, and he was just driving her back to the conference center, which was now the nursing home and isolation ward for incoming refugees who were allowed to stay.
"So what the hell is going on?" Tom asked.
"They're broadcasting off the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln, part of our fleet stationed in the Persian Gulf when things started. They beelined it back here. They said the carrier was somewhere off the coast of the United States and was now the command post for relief and recovery operations. They said that help is on the way." Kept repeating that every 5 minutes. Said the nation is still under martial law.
"No news there," Kate said.
"What kind of help?"
Tom asked. "Didn't say, other than relief supplies are coming from Britain, Australia, and India and China."
"India and China?" Charlie asked.
"Yes, struck me as strange. That earlier report about a weapon detonated over the Western Pacific."
"Who we fighting?" Tom asked.
"Didn't say. Just that Allied forces are fighting in Iran, Iraq, Korea. Good news is that Charleston, Wilmington, and Norfolk have been declared emergency restructuring centers."
"What the hell does that mean?"
Keller asked. "I guess it means if we have some kind of functional assets overseas that didn't get hit, ships that can provide electrical power, aircraft, trained personnel, they'd be coming back here, and those are three local places."
"Charleston is the nearest, 250 miles away," Charlie sighed. "That won't help us a damn bit."
"I know," John said.
"What about the war?" Tom asked.
"Anything beyond the three cities?"
Kate interjected.
"Nothing else.
Oh, yeah. The president is the former Secretary of State. She's in charge."
No one spoke at that news.
"Apparently the president died aboard Air Force One. They got him up in the air and the plane wasn't hardened sufficiently to absorb the pulse. They didn't say what happened to the vice president or speaker of the House."
"Nothing really that affects us directly," Charlie said, and no one replied.
"Strange, the death of a president, and now we say it doesn't affect us," John thought. "That was it. Then they played music."
"What?"
Charlie cried.
"Music?"
"Patriotic stuff. God Bless America. It faded out with the Battle Hymn of the Republic." John looked around the room. "At least we know they're out there."
"The legendary they," Keller replied coldly. "Doesn't help us here and now with what I've got to talk about."
"Go on," Charlie said.
"In fact, what you just told us, John, depresses the hell out of me. The thought that they're so close. Hell, a month and a half ago, a C-130 loaded with medical supplies could have flown here in an hour from Charleston. Now it's like they're on the far side of the moon." "Doc, why don't you go ahead?"
"Only 13 deaths yesterday," Doc said, and there was a murmur of approval. The lowest number since they had started to keep count. "Two were heart attacks. Two, though, were our dialysis patients. I think that is the last of them. Everyone in our communities who was on dialysis is now dead."
No one spoke.
"We also lost one of our diabetics."
Again no one spoke, but John felt eyes turning towards him. Of course they knew. He stared straight ahead, saying nothing.
"And we had a birth."
"Who?"
Kate asked.
"Mary Turnbill, a healthy 6-pound baby girl, named Grace America Turnbill."
"Damn, that's good,"
Tom said out loud.
8 births so far, and only one lost child and mother. Not much of a statistical base yet, but still it's better than average compared to 150 years ago."
"Good work, Doc,"
Charlie said.
"Well,
I better go from that to the downside of things. In one sense, we are in what I would call the grace period right now, the calm between storms. Our initial die-off in the first days, those needing major medical intervention, the first round of food poisoning, those woefully out of shape, as you know, approximately 1,200 deaths out of 10,500 total here in Black Mountain and Swannanoa. We still don't have an